Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
So what we are looking at is the light at the end of the tunnel, not necessarily a bright, sunny day on the other side of the tunnel.
I know we will have a session and we'll get things done.
The second wave of close down has to be very carefully examined.
We just want only the legal valid votes to be counted.
Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
Oh my gosh, it's awesome. We made history.
And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies.
In the mix, you heard Yale Institute for Global Health Dr. Saad Omer discussing a Pfizer coronavirus vaccine now under development, the new Democratic and Republican leaders of the state House, along with President Donald Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and Connecticut demonstrators in both the Biden and Trump camps. Also, we heard President-elect Joe Biden. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today, I'm broadcasting remotely from the parking lot outside a landscaping company in Northeast Philly. On the panel today, Rennie Fulco is here, Director of Public Policy and Law at Trinity College. Rennie, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
And also with us, Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show, also a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut. Colin, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good morning, Lucy and Paz and Rennie.
And you can join us, too, on Twitter at WMPR Wheelhouse. As we know, Biden was declared the winner of the presidential election over the weekend. He has proclaimed victory, but President Donald Trump is not conceding. Trump's administration and the GOP have filed multiple lawsuits. However, the legal actions that have been filed on Trump's behalf so far have failed to gain much traction. I'll start with you, Rennie. Let's talk about these legal efforts. They haven't made much headway. What's your reaction to the argument? And what's happened so far?
Sure. So I would begin with a story in the New York Times. And I will read just a couple lines here. But the Times contacted the offices of top election officials in every state on Monday and Tuesday, and none reported any evidence of illegal voting. 45 states officials responded. Texas is among the states that did not respond. But there has not been a single verified report of either voter fraud or some of the other kinds of allegations that have been made by the Trump administration.
It's no surprise that Trump is not conceding, and there's a challenge now with the outcome of this election. But is it possible in any way, Rennie, that some of these legal fights over ballots, especially those in states like Pennsylvania, could actually swing the outcome? Or is this pretty ridiculous from the Trump team?
I think, you know, we want to be really factual. And based on everything I have read, even if some of these claims were true, given what the margins are and the number of votes that would have to have been submitted fraudulently, there is really no way that I think this is going to work as a real legal strategy. But I don't think that's the purpose of what they're doing.
So what is the point, Rennie? Is it mostly about reaching his base? So what do you think is the strategy here?
I mean, I think it is, again, certainly to reach his base, but I also think it's that he is simply unwilling, you know, to give up, and the people around him are willing to support that. And I think that's what's so troubling, right? Because there's no question that this is, in my view, you know, it only serves to undermine the democratic process, which many people have already said. And I do think it has a political purpose. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of talk that what, for example, Majority Leader McConnell is interested in is keeping people, you know, really ginned up for the two runoffs on January 5th in Georgia for those two Senate seats. But I think it has a darker, I think it has a darker impact. Let's put it that way.
Colin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, in response to that, yeah, I think that there's sort of a combination of things. And there are people, I mean, first of all, remember, Trump keeps cleaning house, you know, until he's sort of got this refined product at the end, which is a bunch of sycophants around him who are going to do what he wants them to do. Dan Dresner wrote a book called Toddler in Chief. And I mean, this is sort of a protracted tantrum on Trump's part. It may also be a way of distracting us from other stuff that could be coming out as a result of his losing the power to control his own destiny. Most of these lawsuits, I would agree with Rennie that, you know, it's sort of like they're treating the legal system like a slot machine. They just keep pulling the lever, hoping three cherries are going to come up somewhere. A lot of them, you know, Dahlia Lithwick of Slate said this is not the A-team in most cases prosecuting or pursuing this litigation. You don't see Paul Clement or Ben Ginsburg, who has completely taken himself out of the play on this one, or Ted Olson. You don't see famous Republican litigators pursuing these. They've made mistakes. They've done stuff like forget to ask for to specify relief in one case. I think in Michigan they filed in the wrong court. You know, there's one case in Pennsylvania that probably is going to go to the Supreme Court. It's not about voter fraud or anything like that. It's a jurisdictional question about who has the right to extend the mail-in ballot deadline. Is it the Pennsylvania Supreme Court or their legislature? But, you know, ultimately, this isn't Florida. It isn't like this, you know, it isn't just one state would need to be decided in a different way. It's a bunch of states. The margin isn't hundreds of votes. It's thousands of votes. Biden was up by 45,000 in Pennsylvania yesterday. It's hard to imagine some kind of litigation effort that would turn around 45,000 votes. So yeah, I mean, this is mostly a lot of junk that is being used to discredit the process in a way that I think a lot of Republicans find pretty dangerous and pretty alarming. Now, I would agree with Rennie also. I think if you took the Georgia runoffs out of the equation, you'd see McConnell striking a slightly different pose about all this. I mean, it can't be comforting to him to know what's going on right now.
Colin, remind us. Go ahead, Rennie.
I was just going to add one more thing to follow up on what Colin said, if I could. There was some of you may know or may not know that there was actually an allegation last week in Erie County that supposedly there was an individual in the post office who had observed voter fraud in the post office that had to do with the dating of ballots. And earlier this week, on Monday, this individual recanted that allegation. And that was something that the Trump administration, you know, had been touting, that this was kind of the opening that they were looking for. And in fact, this individual has now recanted. And so it just, I think, provides further evidence of the theatrical aspect of what is going on here.
That issue that you raised, Rennie, that was something that even Senator Lindsey Graham pointed to as possible evidence of voter fraud. And so I wanted to ask you, Mark Pazniokas, you know, when you think about how Republicans have responded, especially prominent ones, to these claims from the Trump administration, are you surprised?
I was initially surprised, but I think that the analysis that Mitch McConnell has his eye on January, I think that's the correct one. I think this is really an effort to keep the base revved up in Georgia until those runoff elections take place and that control of the Senate is settled for the next 2 years. But, you know, Rennie started off by reading, you know, that about that New York Times survey of election officials. I just want to make a point about that. That is one extraordinary front page. There's a banner headline, election officials nationwide find no fraud. You know, old reporters like Colin and I, you know, we grew up with a certain set of expectations about news. We were taught that the ordinary is not news. The expected is not news. The dog bites man is not news. You know, the absence of fraud in a normal time is not news, but yet today it is. And that's one hell of a thing to be confronting. You know, the Republicans who are talking as though this is still unresolved, they know the facts. There's a century or more of political experience and jurisprudence about what happens with elections. successful statewide recounts are extraordinarily rare. They start with, you know, crazy thin margins. You know, Al Franken in 2008 trailed by 206 votes out of nearly 3 million cast, and a recount gave him a victory of 312 votes. Those are the instances where you see results changed. The idea that you're going to have successful statewide legal challenges or recounts in 3, 4, 5, 6 states is just absurd. The Republicans know it's absurd. The history and our experience tells us it's absurd. You know, Biden won Michigan by 140, 150,000 votes. Yeah, he's up almost 50,000 in Pennsylvania yesterday, 20,000 in Wisconsin, 13,000 in Arizona, and 12,000 in Georgia. And Arizona and Georgia are the ones that, you know, people are thinking are still really in play. And Arizona, other than Fox and maybe the AP, I don't remember now, but, you know, a lot of networks are not calling Arizona. But even there, 13,000 votes is not insignificant.
Colin, we've been talking about, you know, Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, but we've got to bring up Joe Lieberman. What's he been saying about this election?
Well, as usual, Joe Lieberman is saying things that make it hard to exactly pin down what Joe Lieberman thinks. Yet he talks nonetheless, and he writes op-eds in the Wall Street Journal. I would say that if you parse everything that he has said about this, I mean, he wrote a really annoying piece at in the Wall Street Journal where he did total both sidesism. Both sides have to, you know, accept the election results. Both sides have to put, you know, the interest of the country above their own personal interests. You know, there's only one side that is misbehaving here right now. There's only one side that is questioning the legitimacy of this election, and he somehow or other got through a whole op-ed without kind of making that point. Since then, he's gone on a couple of shows. He was with Neil Cavuto, I think maybe last night, and he's made it more clear, I think, that, you know, I mean, obviously he has some little direct experience with this. He was Al Gore's running mate. He actually, inside the Gore campaign, was one of the people saying, no, let's stay and fight. We haven't expended every round of ammunition we've got here. Let's stay in the battle. And Gore ultimately overrode that, and with some unexpended avenues of pursuit, decided it was time to call it. And Lieberman's now saying that he was wrong that time and Gore was right. So I don't know, if you parse everything that he says, he's kind of saying that Trump is going to have to calm down pretty soon, but not, you know, in the usual kind of murky Joe Lieberman way, he's managed to drip his ice cream cone down both of his legs at the same time.
Well, and one of the things here that, you know, we've got to emphasize, it's not just Republicans saying, you know, every avenue should be exhausted. Mm-hmm. It's the president's rhetoric as he's saying that. Mm-hmm. On its face, there's nothing wrong with saying, I want to be 100% certain that nothing wrong happened. You know, Mitt Romney made that point the other day. The problem here is that Trump is doing far more than that. He is not simply saying, hey, I want to double check the numbers. I want to cut the cards. He's pronouncing he won. He's pronouncing there's widespread fraud. He is really speaking in fantastic terms about things that did not happen. And that, of course, is the problem here. He is keeping a divided country agitated. And that is really the issue here, you know, as opposed to if there was really something in Pennsylvania they want to pursue, then there's a way to pursue it without walking around with a lit match around, you know, a bunch of people holding gas cans.
Rennie, Mark just mentioned Trump rhetoric, but what about what's happening within the Trump administration as well? So the DOJ, you know, are they getting involved? We heard Secretary of State Pompeo making the statement, a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. How worried should we be?
Well, I'm always worried. So you're probably asking the wrong person. I worry a lot. I mean, you know, at least in terms of what I think is plausible, I think that Trump, you know, as his niece has said on every network, right, over the past week, Mary Trump, he's going to burn the house down on his way out. I mean, that is his way. What I think is dangerous, again, is just the undermining of the institutions. I mean, it's not clear to me what's going on, let's say, you know, at the Pentagon. It is clear to me that Bill Barr, you know, has been on a mission, you know, to support Trump from day one. But again, I'm just not sure what they can actually do. In other words, you know, Barr says he wants every allegation, you know, to be investigated, and he's putting federal people in at a time he shouldn't. And somebody, you know, who's been there for years had to resign because Mr. Pilger had to resign because of this. But it's not clear to me what they can actually do. I think the rhetoric itself is extremely corrosive. And I must say, I, at least as of yesterday, I thought that the Biden camp, you know, the Biden camp is responding correctly by not giving it more oxygen, by simply saying we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and we're going to continue to do what we're supposed to be doing. And I think that's very important, not to let Trump control this narrative.
Colin, do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we've come to a point here now where a lot of things that should be happening, that need to be happening, that happen as a matter of norms are not happening, particularly as regards the transition. So in other words, you know, really at this point, Biden should be fully included on some of the daily briefings, should be getting a lot more information than he is getting. The only reason that this is not happening is because not only is Trump refusing to accept the pretty clear results of the election, not only is Barr threatening to dispatch flying monkeys to states around the country to investigate kind of invisible claims of fraud, but you know, the basic transition stuff isn't happening. The GSA has not done the basic green lighting that begins the process where a president taking over needs to knows what he needs, he or she hopefully someday needs to know, and that's a problem. And yes, also, as both of my fellow panelists have said, there's something incendiary about the rhetoric that's going on along with it. You know, that notion, there are a lot of fired up people out there, and not all of them are mentally stable. And so to say this kind of stuff and convince your followers that there's something really wrong and evil about these election results is an invitation, not just to chaos, but to possible violence and mayhem. And I think we've had enough of that already in 2020.
Let's talk about the president-elect's administration. Several people with ties to Connecticut are in the mix for roles in the Biden administration. Yale professor Marcella Nunez-Smith is one of the three co-chairs of Biden's coronavirus task force. Let's talk a little bit about what we know about her, Mark. I believe she researches healthcare equity. Is this a sign that the Biden administration is paying attention to the disparities we've seen in this pandemic?
Yes, that's her area of expertise. She sits on the board of Connecticut Voices for Children, which has a focus in that area. And she also was one of the people that Governor Lamont relied on when he looked at the issues of how to deal with reopen Connecticut and the vaccine. I'm sorry, rather the vaccine issue. And so, yeah, I mean, she is somebody who you would think would be on the list. Now, as a journalist, I have to tell you, these are the stories that interest me the least. the list stories of who's being mentioned. But it does reflect something substantive, even if she ultimately is not chosen. These are statements about the values of an incoming administration, the type of people they're looking at, you know, which is always an element of sort of the vetting game on vice president. This is a little different because the politics are not as fraught. It's really a question of, okay, what is it we're trying to do? You know, I know you're going to mention Dan Esty, who's also at Yale. It's going to be an interesting time for Yale. But, you know, he's mentioned his potential EPA administrator. You know, he would be interesting because he is really not an environmental crusader. He's he's kind of an environmental economist almost. I mean, he looks at how markets work, which is kind of an interesting approach to this stuff. And energy, that's what brought him to the administration of Governor Daniel Malloy. But I think when we read all these stories about who's being mentioned, you got to keep that in the back of your mind about you know, sometimes people are on a list, not because they're really being considered, but they're on a list because the incoming administration wants to say something about the types of people that they're looking to include.
So Dan Esty is a possible on the list of ahead of the EPA. We'll just ignore you, Mark, for the rest of the segment then, so we'll be talking about lists. But I wanted to go back to Rennie Folco. When we think about this coronavirus task force, the fact that here in Connecticut, our positivity rate is 6.7%, this idea that the Biden administration is taking this seriously, it's definitely a departure from what we have seen with the current administration.
Yes, that's an understatement. And I think, I mean, I would agree with Mark that I think part of what's going on here, and again, I'm not the first person to say this by any means, but I think, you know, Biden and the people around him want to send a message that they're serious, that this is their number one issue, and that they're getting down to business, even if it's in his basement or whatever it is. You know, they ran a campaign from his basement and they won. And I think they really want to demonstrate that they're getting to work. And I think the contrast between what President-elect Biden and Harris, Vice President-elect Harris, are doing, the contrast with, you know, what we talked about just a few minutes ago. I mean, the entire energy of the Trump administration is going into discovering invisible voter fraud claims, right? In other words, they're still campaigning and the Biden team is beginning to govern. And I just think that's really important. And I think, Mark, I'm building on what you're saying here, that part of this is messaging from the very beginning. And obviously, what are they saying? We're going to have people who are scientists. We are going to have people who are, you know, reality based on our team. And I think, you know, it's sort of what Mark said earlier, you know, should this be a headline, right? Why is it a headline that we're going to have people in government who know something? But it seems to me that in 2020, that point has to be made.
Colin, also Chris Dodd has been, it's been reported that he might become the ambassador to Ireland. People are talking about Chris Murphy again for Secretary of State. You know, how do you view these names coming out of Connecticut as possible contenders to be the administration?
All right. Yeah. So just to run through pretty quickly, I just wanted to say one thing about the task force, which is a little bit different from lists of possible people getting jobs. It's an interesting task force. To me, the most interesting name on it is Rick Bright. Rick Bright was a vaccine expert within the federal government who turned whistleblower and therefore was pushed out by the Trump administration. It's the kind of task force I've sort of spent a lot of time kind of learning this landscape a little bit. It's the kind of task force that you would form if you really felt like you had a solution almost in hand, that you were going to have some effective vaccines available at the beginning of next year. And the question is, you know, how are you going to distribute them? How are you going to get them out? I think I'm correct in saying that reflects their vision, as opposed to a competing vision that might be, you know, it's going to take a long time to vaccinate everybody. We're going to have to get better at testing than we are right now. We're going to have to live alongside this virus for a while. In terms of Dan Esty, I don't know. Dan Esty, he always drives me a little bit nuts. And so I went back and I read a recent piece that he wrote about how the response to COVID could be very hopeful in terms of responding to climate change. And he says, finally, the economic peril of COVID got Republicans and Democrats in the Congress to work together like no other issue in a generation. With the American public's well-being on the line, each party had to compromise and put aside partisan grandstanding. Similar flexibility and a spirit of give and take will be required to deliver a successful response to climate change. You know, I kind of missed the whole part where the two parties put their partisan differences in grandstanding aside. I just didn't see that. I don't live in the same world as Dan Esty. It seems to me that this basic medical and scientific question has been made partisan in a way that I wouldn't have thought possible going into it. So, you know, he has a kind of sunny bipartisan cheerleading quality that always makes me a little bit nervous. If Chris Dodd gets to be ambassador to Ireland, he'll be the second one recently from here. Tom Foley completed a time there. I guess he kind of is fixing up the house there. I don't think it really matters who's the ambassador to Ireland that much. Ireland seems to think it is going to be Dodd. He does have property in the West. I think he'd be quite happy doing that. A nice capstone for his career. We've talked about Murphy in the past. Yep. I think, you know, Murphy's Murphy's intellectual credentials as a possible Secretary of State are formidable. And the question is, would he want to give up the job? And I don't think he knows whether he would want to give up the job until he sees how Georgia turns out, because it's a different job if you're in the majority than if you're in the minority. So I think I ran through all of them.
If Murphy gets offered Secretary of State, he's going. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. That's the one job that it's the offer you cannot refuse. And anything less than that, I think you're right. He would stick where he is. Because really, in a special election for U.S. Senate, there's no such thing as the absolute safe state. I mean, let's remember a guy named Scott Brown in Massachusetts, a Republican succeeding Ted Kennedy. So in what at best will be a 50-50 Senate, I think the Biden people have got to be very careful about, you know, coaxing anybody from the U.S. Senate into the administration.
Right. Mark, go ahead, Rennie.
Yeah, just to add one other thing. I think that, you know, at least the list that I've seen of potential candidates, I do think there are people with a lot more actual experience in the world. And I love Chris Murphy, so I'm not saying he doesn't have experience in the world, but people who already have relationships, I think, with a lot of the foreign leaders, where we need to repair those relationships. And so I just wonder, you know, what the calculus will be, because obviously, in my view, Murphy is qualified, but then you've got this question of experience, and to what extent does the Biden administration feel like they really need to kind of build on that experience immediately, given all the problems.
So producer Matt Dwyer is going to murder me because I'm blowing through the clock here. But Mark, I got to ask, since we've been talking about Connecticut people should know that Justin Clark, who's a West Hartford native, is one of the strategists behind the Trump team's strategy to challenge the election results.
Yes, and yet the West Hartford Republican Town Committee offered its congratulations to Joe Biden over the weekend. Justin Clark is somebody who has always kind of mystified me. He is the mildest mannered guy you can talk to. I dealt with him when he was running Tom Foley's campaigns, and the fact that he would end up in the Trump administration, and he went in at a relatively low level, you know, intergovernmental affairs. And then he ended up on the political side. So it's been interesting. I don't know where Justin Clark goes from here, but it's been interesting to watch. I mean, he had a law partner who was, let's say, not somebody who was terribly sympathetic to Trump. I know people in his circle, and it's just kind of fun to watch. Not really fun, but it's just a little odd. Again, he's just never been that personality that you would put together with this president.
Except behind, I'll screw up the clock a little bit more. Except behind closed doors. So about a year ago, Clark was meeting with Republicans in Wisconsin. He thought it was a closed door meeting. Somebody had a tape recorder, and Clark talked pretty openly about what we would call voter suppression. He said, good news, this is the first election where the consent decree is not in effect. That's the one that requires parties to, you know, basically tell the federal Justice Department what they're going to do in terms of election day operations. So it was kind of like the gloves are off. We can do what we want in terms of voter suppression. So, you know, he may be one of these guys who has one face to the outside world and another when he thinks nobody's looking.
This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk more about Connecticut, including our governor, who jumped on the Joe Biden bandwagon early. Stay with us. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. Our panelists today, Rennie Fulco, Director of Public Policy and Law at Trinity College, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio. Now, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont got on the Joe Biden bandwagon early. Now Lamont's hoping Connecticut will reap some reward after the Democratic president-elect's win. Mark, you wrote about Lamont's support of Biden fairly early. Talk about that.
Well, it's sort of the classic Ned Lamont story. By by that, I mean, it's kind of weird. You know, Ned Lamont has this endearing at times, frustrating at times, goofy quality about his approach to politics. He is not an instinctive politician by any means. And so on the day in April 2019, when Joe Biden opened up his campaign for president and put out his announcement, the governor sent a contribution immediately, you know, really. And this is something that normally a sitting governor would talk about with his staff, because it's going to be public. It is a commitment. And it was days, if not weeks, before he mentioned it to anybody on his staff, which is kind of funny. But it's also sort of, it says something about Ned Lamont. He was not looking to do any kind of political calculation about where he should position himself. He's very comfortable with Joe Biden's approach to government and politics. The things that frustrate progressives about Biden, you know, the idea that he takes a more cautious and incremental view of things, that's Ned Lamont. That's Ned Lamont's approach to government, with probably the one exception of the big play he made for tolls in 2019. You know, Ned Lamont had told people before Biden was elected that he really liked Biden and that he thought if Biden got in, he would win, which was hardly the conventional wisdom back in the day.
Colin, what did you think when you read Mark's story about Lamont's donation, but also just how he went about it?
Well, I mean, I could have this totally wrong, but what I saw was a guy who spent more of his life in the donor class than in the political office seeker class. He's probably spent more time either writing checks or fending off people wanting him to write checks than he has spent doing the opposite, doing what politicians have to do. And he may have just sort of reflexively thought, oh, yeah, I like Biden. Sure, I'll send him. Apparently, he didn't know how to max out. Pass reported that he was $200 over. But you know, I mean, that's sort of what I saw. And, you know, I just would extend this also, the story, to Connecticut a little bit. I mean, we have sort of conventional wisdom leading politicians. Bicewicz went for Biden. Almost all of the congressional delegation went for Biden, the outlier being Hayes, who went to Harris. So we've kind of got all of our bases covered. You have to go down ticket to Lembo and Merrill, who were Elizabeth Warren endorsers, to find people who are maybe kind of crawling out on the progressive limb a little bit more. But basically, our congressional delegation and our main leadership, executive leadership here, they are the kind of centrist who would pretty naturally endorse Biden, and also the kind of people who would endorse Biden because they associate him with kind of pre-existing power. So, and I don't know if that does us any good, you know, down the line when we need help or we need money, but it's probably better to have done that than to have done something else.
And, you know, just one quick point about Lamont being part of the donor class. You're right. But this was not an instance of a guy writing checks to a bunch of Democrats, because people in the donor class quite frequently will do that.
Oh, yeah.
You have a field of 20 and there's a bunch of people in there you like and you want to help them out. The only check he wrote or credit card transaction he did was for Joe Biden. The same was true with his wife, although their daughter, Emily, sent money early on to Pete Buttigieg. So this was not a family decision. But anyway, I just want to make that point. I mean, this is a deep and early commitment to Joe Biden, I think, on a bunch of levels. And again, you know, this governor is, relatively speaking, clueless when it comes to transactional politics. So, you know, it's not like this is something he did because, oh, okay, I can now get X. I think he believes Connecticut can benefit from Biden being in the White House. You know, this governor and others around the country are desperate for something to happen on the next stimulus package. There are a lot of states that are in the hole because of the pandemic recession. But anyway, it's Lamont has always been an interesting guy to cover because he is not a conventional political figure.
You know, Rennie, I was asking Mark earlier if this could help Connecticut, that our governor was supporting Biden quite early. But then I think about some of our very high profile delegation members, like Rosa DeLauro, who I believe, will she be in line to be the chair of the Appropriations Committee?
Yes, I think somebody correct me. I believe that that is correct.
She's in a contest with Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
That's it. So she's certainly up there. And I mean, look, I don't think that the Biden administration is, you know, how can I put this? I think they will want to help every state. You know, I don't think we're going to be seeing, you know, again, this is sort of the whiplash from what's been going on. You know, that we have a president who only helps the states, you know, who support him. I don't think that's the issue. But I do think that there are a lot of, you know, people in Congress, in both houses from Connecticut, who will work well with Biden. In other words, even I think people who may be further to the left are still going to work with Biden. So I just sort of see it as a given that to the degree that he can be helpful to the state, you know, the administration, he will be. And we're also going to have people in Congress who are going to be working as well, because, you know, we've been living in this moment of, you know, government by executive order, right? And I think, you know, that's why this Georgia election is so important, because, you know, it's obviously, at least many people think it's a long shot, but if the Democrats were able, you know, to win those two seats, then I think it will be a very different picture. As it stands, it's not clear to me how much legislation will get done if the Republicans, you know, maintain control.
Colin, do you remember when Hillary Clinton was running and people were wondering if Dan Malloy would move on to her administration? Is that a question that's even being raised with Ned Lamont?
I don't see that Ned Lamont, no, you know, and I think everything that's being said here is correct, that the truth is that the, you know, Connecticut has a delegation full of people who've been in power for a really long time, been in their seats for a really long time. Larson, Courtney, DeLauro, Himes, you know, these people are all long serving members of Congress with a lot of ties. And I do think it's sort of worth separating two things there. One of them is, you're right, Rennie, that, you know, Trump has this infantile way of talking about blue states and red states and states that didn't support him. So you can't have any vaccines because you weren't nice to me. You know, that kind of thing. That's obviously just, you know, beyond the pale. But there's a subtler kind of power and influence that can be wielded successfully by states with delegations that just have more access, can get a meeting, you know, not necessarily with Biden, but with Ron Klain or somebody. And if you're John Larson or somebody like that, you just know how to navigate all that stuff. And you've known Biden for a long time, just being up there. And that probably is an advantage. It's hard to know where the advantage will crop up.
So, Mark Pasniokas, you were covering the General Assembly on Election Day. So give us the run through of the new leaders on the block, so to speak.
Sure. There's a lot of new talent at the top of the four main caucus leader positions. We have three new leaders. Matt Ritter, who will be the House Speaker. Vin Candelora will be the House Republican leader, and Kevin Kelly will be the Senate Republican leader. And then you also have a new House Majority Leader in Jason Rojas, who it certainly appears likely that he will be the first person of color, the first racial minority to take over one of what we consider the Capitol to be the big six leadership jobs, House Speaker, Senate President Pro Tem, and then the you know, majority leaders and minority leaders of the two chambers. Now, what difference will that make? I mean, that's really, I think, the broader question for Connecticut. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, Ritter is a Hartford Democrat who is certainly left of center, as anybody who's elected in Hartford is. But he also is very mindful of the diversity of a large caucus. And, you know, one of the things that you have to think about after an election like this, where the Democrats did add seats, But they added seats with people from different parts of the state, and not everybody is going to be progressive on every issue, particularly taxes. You have a couple of new people, new Democrats who are from pretty affluent suburbs in Fairfield County and elsewhere. And that is always the talent of, particularly in the House, of the Speaker and the Majority Leader, of how to meld a very diverse caucus into a program of public policy and legislation.
You mentioned the Big Six. Why are there no women legislators filling these roles now that Themis Claridis has moved on?
Yeah, and you know, Themis was always very fond of pointing that out, and she loved teasing the Democrats about that. The short answer is I don't know. There are more and more women getting involved in General Assembly politics, of running for the General Assembly. In the new class of 16 new House Democrats, it's 50-50. So maybe over time that will change. Connecticut has had more representation of women in the legislature than in other states, but it still never approached 50%, and that's part of it. Connecticut has had a woman as the House Speaker, Moira Lyons, but you're right. Right now, there's probably the most prominent women in legislative leadership positions would be Tony Walker, who's mm-hmm. been the appropriations co-chair in the House for 10 years. And, you know, she's a very influential legislator, very skillful legislator. But yeah, there's not a lot right now. It is the boys' club for the time being.
And no black lawmakers either in this Big Six, Mark. I do want to bring up too that, is there something going on with the 90th state house seat?
Yes. Yeah, this thing seemed to be going too smoothly this year. It looked like there were going to be no recounts. But on Monday, the people in Wallingford discovered that there were votes missing, or not votes missing. There was a failure to post the results from one of the nine polling places in the 90th House District of Cheshire and Wallingford. And when you added those in, it was discovered that Craig Fishbein, the Republican who was deemed to be the loser last week, now it looks like he's the winner by 21 votes. That requires an automatic recount. It's unclear why there was confusion last week, because the two campaigns, they didn't rely on what was uploaded to the state's election management system. They tend to rely on the actual numbers they get at the polls. You know, so we'll find out Thursday. There'll be a recount Thursday. But I mean, that was a hard one for Democrats, because Craig Fishbein has a unique talent in really annoying Democrats. He's one of the legislators who sued the governor over masks and other COVID restrictions. And he was actually unopposed until June, but he retweeted something that, you know, was really a racist meme. And that caused a Cheshire town councilman named Jim Jinks to jump in June and either come close to beating him, or we'll find out on Thursday, perhaps maybe he still did, you know.
That's Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Renny Folco is also here, Director of Public Policy and Law at Trinity College. And Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show here on The Wheelhouse. Coming up, we catch up with someone you have not heard about in a while. Stay tuned. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. It's time to highlight a story that crossed late last week but was overshadowed by the election. That's a story involving former Governor John Rowland. He's been on probation after completing a prison sentence from his second criminal conviction for violating campaign finance laws. His probation is set to expire next May, but Rowland had asked a judge to be released from probation early. The judge said no. Now, Colin, John Rowland was before my time in Connecticut, but who does this guy think he is? Why did he ask for early release from probation?
Well, he thinks he's John Rowland. I don't know. This has been such a long saga, and Rowland was drastically underpunished in 2004. He may have been overpunished the second time around for what he did in the 2012 campaigns. It's been dragging on so long, and I'm almost at the point of reversing where I used to be for a long time. You know, I mean, I don't know how this fits in on the overall continuum of how people are treated in these situations. But, you know, if Rowland can kind of get back to being an actual productive member of society and doing some good, you know, with this is the Chuck Colson group that he works for. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing. I mean, how long does this whole thing have to go on? I mean, what he did was wrong the second time, too, but not as drastically wrong as the way he acted while governor.
Hmm. So, Mark, what is John Rowland doing now that he would ask for probation to be released? It had to do with his job.
Yeah, he's working with, as Colin said, you know, Colson's group, which is tries to help prisoners after they get out of prison. And, you know, I'm resisting any urge at all to be snarky about that. He certainly has experience in that area. You know, the thing with Rowland is it's always been a question of what is in his heart, what is sincere. You know, it seems at this point, the man's 63. He certainly could choose to go in other ways. I mean, I don't know that he has any incentive to do this for, you know, for public image at this point. I don't see AM radio putting him back on at this point, but, you know, I'm kind of amazed he got on in the first place and that they kept him on, even though he was clearly using it for his own purposes. So, as my mother used to say, as far as him trying to get the early end to the supervision, it never hurts to ask. It just never hurts to ask. And that's what he did. So I don't find it to be anything that is offensive or shocks. It's at this point, you know, he's saying, you know, he's an adult and he can do this work without checking in with his parole officer every month or so.
So let's move on to feats of strength. Rennie Folka.
Oh, okay. A shout out to Denise Merrill and her team. I think they really did a remarkable job. If we have only one, you know, contested vote that we're looking at here, and I think things ran smoothly, and I just as a citizen, I appreciate what they did.
Colin?
I'm going to do a feat of strength for some of the Connecticut Republicans who have taken not just the high road, but the right road in terms of congratulating Biden and, you know, trying to get past this, you know, very, very toxic tantrum that Trump is having. That would include Mark Boughton, who was always kind of a never Trumper anyway. Aaron Stewart, the Republican mayor of New Britain, who every time she does something like this, she gets torn apart on social media by Republican trolls. But she's doing the right thing. And then this guy, Daniela Altamari, wrote about this guy, Artie Adusi. I hope I'm saying his name right, where I think he was the Republican vice chair in South Windsor. And he wrote this really soul-searching post about why he became a Republican and why this is not the party he thought he had joined.
And Mark, we've got 30 seconds.
I would say people like Anna Pozniak and Sue Larson, one is a town clerk, the other one is a registrar. I believe they are the true heroes of this, not Merrill's office. It's really Connecticut elections are local operations. Connecticut has no infrastructure to handle the volume of absentee ballots that came in. And these local officials performed admirably.
I just want to say, you know, today is Veterans Day, but for Connecticut resident Mike Zakea, November 11th is his alive day. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps when he was seriously wounded in the Second Battle of Fallujah in 2004. In the years since he left the service, he's become a tireless advocate for veterans in our state and across the country. My feat goes to Mike Zakea. Today's show produced by Matt Dwyer. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. We'll be back next week.